Broadcasting in HD radio at 88.9 FM, this is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, and KBDH San Ardo. Streaming live and podcasting at KUSP.org. Hey everybody, I'm Gary Shapiro, and it's time for From the Bookshelf.
On May 21st, 1924, two teenage boys, Nathan F. Leopold, 19, and Richard Loeb, 18, kidnapped and murdered Bobby Franks, 14. Leopold and Loeb were both handsome sons of privilege who had excelled in education. The case riveted the nation at the time and has fascinated ever since. Their lawyer, the acclaimed attorney of the damned, Clarence Darrow, fought the state's attorney, Robert Crow, to save the lives of Leopold and Loeb. My guest this week is Simon Botts, author of For the Thrill of It, Leopold, Loeb, and the Murder That Shocked Chicago. Simon Botts, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Hi, thank you for having me on your show.
You know, so the case has been written about in nonfiction books as well as movies and novels. You know, what brought you to approach it again?
It's interesting because, as you said, there have been several films about the case, and there have even been novels about the case, and I happened to be in London one afternoon, and I had a spare afternoon, and I saw the movie Rope, which is a classic Hitchcock movie based on the Leopold and Loeb case. And when I got to know more, a little bit more about the case, I realized that there had not been a book written which covered the case in its complexity, and by that I think I mean the scientific part of the testimony that was introduced into the trial. I think the other thing that struck me about it was that it's really quite an amazing and extraordinary case, and it could be written, a book could be written about the case as though it, almost as though it were a novel, and in part that's what I've tried to do in writing my book, which just came out.
So in the book, you have the difficulty of telling a murder mystery that everybody knows the answer to.
Yes, I think a lot of people are familiar with the case. I'm not sure everybody knows the answer, because some people do and some people don't. But despite that, I think there were so many different twists and turns that I was able to keep the story moving along, and the reader wasn't going to know what actually happened until I brought it into the book.
Right.
And I think a good example of that is Darrow's strategy when he was faced with what seemed to him to be an almost impossible case. That Darrow had an extraordinary record in the previous 30 years as an attorney. He had never had a client sentenced to death. And here were two boys, neither of whom expressed any remorse for the killing that they had done, both of whom were tied very closely to evidence linking them to the murder, and of course they had confessed to the police, and so it seemed as though they were going to be executed, and Darrow very cleverly had a strategy up his sleeve which helped him save them from the gallows.
Well, we'll be careful not to give everything away in your book.
Okay.
What about your personal feelings? Are you a death penalty opponent, advocate? What are your personal feelings about the death penalty?
It's a very interesting question, because I think everybody knows of these cases that are so extraordinarily gruesome and unpleasant that I think a lot of people have an instinctual feeling towards the death penalty. I think to a certain extent, I share Darrow's point of view, which is that people are determined according to their upbringing, their education, their genetic inheritance. Those things have an effect on people. And so the question, and I think it's a question that Darrow pushed to the extreme, is how responsible are individuals for their actions? And that was really the debate at the center of the case, because Darrow was saying that Leopold and Loeb are not responsible for their actions, and Robert Crow, the state's attorney, was saying that they are fully responsible, and the whole case revolved around that. As far as my attitude towards the two boys, I probably would say they shouldn't have got the death penalty, But in this case, it was a very calculated crime, and I think that the prosecution played on that aspect, that the two boys had been planning the crime for a good 6 months. They had taken out alibis. They had been very careful in thinking about how to do it and to get away without being caught. And so that element of calculation, the fact that there was nothing impulsive about it, really, it's difficult to mitigate that in a sense.
Well, is there a case, again, your personal opinion, is there a case in which you would think that the death penalty was appropriate or not?
I'm really kind of hesitant to say that. I think perhaps the murder or the kidnapping of a child is the most gruesome case, I think I share Dara's point of view by saying that, again, I share Dara's point of view, not to the extreme that he pushed it, but I'm saying what good does it do to execute someone? It doesn't bring back the victim. It doesn't achieve anything. I think if you were to really push me on this, I would say no, I don't believe in the death penalty.
All right, good. I got an answer from you.
Okay. You pushed me, and I gave you an answer.
One of the things that strikes me about your book is that there are at least two accounts that I can think of in which the principals in the case wrote their own accounts, and that would be Darrow, who wrote his autobiography, and Nathan F. Leopold, who also wrote an autobiography. And in your book, you contradict both of those accounts substantially. I'm sure you're probably familiar with those accounts. Tell us a little bit about your process of how you came up with your information.
Well, I think one of the things I decided to do was to make my research as comprehensive as I possibly could, to try and find out from as many different sources what actually went on, and also to get the details, the fine details of the case. And I was very lucky because there exists a transcript of the courtroom hearing, and that's a very unusual thing because most transcripts are thrown away almost immediately unless a case goes to an appeal, and this case was not going to go to appeal, of course, because Darrow pleaded the two defendants guilty. And then also I found the psychiatric reports that Darrow's psychiatrists had done on Leopold and Loeb, and I think then the most amazing thing that I found was the stenographic transcripts of the confessions that the two boys made during their first weekend in custody. And all of this material is at Northwestern University in their archives and had been saved for 80-something years. And then I think the next thing that provided me with a tremendous amount of information was that I went through every Chicago newspaper that existed in 1924, and there were six of those newspapers, all five of which have now disappeared, and the only one that remains is the Chicago Tribune. And I went through day by day reading every single article I could find in the Chicago newspapers, and that gave me a very, very comprehensive overview and a very detailed account of what happened. And I was able to stitch all these different accounts together and produce the book. And as a consequence of that, it's very clear that Nathan Leopold's account is very self-serving. He presents his autobiography as someone who is misguided, perhaps has learned his lesson from his youth and is now a very selfless and altruistic individual. And that autobiography was written, incidentally, as part of his appeal to get parole. And so naturally it would be self-serving. With Darrow's autobiography, he wrote it towards the end of his life, and he had been involved in many different cases. And so Leopold and Loeb takes up quite a short amount of his autobiography. What I think in both of those autobiographies, however, is that they don't really get the facts right. And that's perhaps understandable, because in Darrow's case, he was 75 years old when he wrote his autobiography. And in Leopold's case, he wrote his autobiography something like about 30 years after the event. So neither autobiography was very reliable, in fact.
It's interesting. So you were also able to see the things that Leopold and Loeb said to their psychiatrists?
Yes, exactly. And they spent probably about 2 to 3 weeks being examined by their psychiatrists. And their psychiatrist, the psychiatrist wrote up a report, which is very extensive. It's about 500 pages. And both boys would talk about their fantasies. They'd talk about their sexual desires. They talked about the crime and their motivation and why they did it and the details and the thoughts. It was an extraordinary picture that I got of these two boys. And as I said, the transcripts of those psychiatric reports are at the archives at Northwestern University.
In Loeb's discussions with his psychiatrist, did he acknowledge that he was in fact the one that clubbed Bobby Franks with the chisel?
He did, yes. And the thing was that he was asked at one point by one of the psychiatrists why he didn't come out and say that publicly, why he would only say it to a psychiatrist. And his initial reason for not confessing to the actual deed was that when Leopold and Loeb first confessed, each one had hoped to blame the other for the actual act, to put the responsibility for initiating the crime on each other's shoulders. And then later, when they realized that they were both liable for the death penalty, Loeb still refused to come out publicly because he wanted to spare his mother that anguish of knowing that he had been the person responsible for initiating the crime. And that seems rather strange in a sense, because here is someone who had done this very heinous crime, who had not expressed any remorse, and yet he wanted to save his mother that anguish of knowing that her son was the murderer, in fact. So he never confessed except incidentally to one of the psychiatrists, who did, though, note it down in his report.
We're speaking with Simon Batz, and his book is called For the Thrill of It. It's a book about the famous Leopold and Loeb case. Why in the world did they confess?
That's another interesting question, and Leopold, in fact, addresses that in his autobiography, and because you would not have thought of the two, you would not have thought that Leopold would confess, because after all, he was a law student at the University of Chicago, and both Leopold and Loeb were brilliant students. One of them, Leopold, had graduated from Chicago as an undergraduate at the age of 18, and Richard Loeb had graduated at the age of 17 from the University of Michigan. And the reason why they confessed is because the state's attorney presented them with evidence that was irrefutable. The state's attorney, Robert Crowe, broke their alibi. And their feeling was, well, they know we did it. What can we possibly save by denying the crime? And I think the other motivation was that they would put the blame on each other's shoulders. I think in the case of Richard Loeb, he was trying to ingratiate himself with the state's attorney in the possibility that the state's attorney would reduce the charges against him. So they did have motivations for doing that, but quite clearly. The other thing that was going against them, of course, was that they were arrested on Thursday afternoon. The families of both boys were very complacent and did not believe that either of their sons could be guilty, and so were very complacent, did not call in the lawyers, did not contact Darrow until the weekend, and by that time it was too late because the state's attorney was able to keep them in custody over the weekend, and habeas corpus could not be applied for at the court until Monday morning. And so by the time Darrow got to them, they had fully confessed, and Darrow did, as soon as he got access to them, did say, stop talking, and they immediately clammed up once Darrow told them that. And then Darrow set about the task of saving them from the death penalty. Neither one was going to be released or found innocent, and Darrow's job from that point on was to get the lesser penalty of life in prison rather than the death penalty, and that's what Darrow then set out to do.
So if this case had happened in modern times, their confessions would have been thrown out of court?
Yes, I think, because we now have the Miranda warning, and that didn't exist in 1924. The other thing that was interesting for me when I read the newspapers was the newspaper accounts was that both Darrow and Robert Crowe would talk quite freely to the newspapers before the case in an attempt to spin it, and the newspapers would speculate endlessly. And so it would have been extremely difficult if this had gone before a jury to have found a jury that would have known nothing about the case or would not have had an opinion about it. But you're right that the fact that the legal safeguards that we now have didn't exist in 1924.
Do you think that Leopold and Loeb had committed other crimes that we don't know about, other than stealing the typewriter and killing Bobby Franks?
Yes, it's quite clear that they did. I mean, and this ranges from rather minor crimes such as stealing cars. That's clearly indicated, and there's evidence of that in the psychiatric reports. But more seriously, the police linked them to other murders, and I think that's something new about my book, which hasn't come out in previous accounts. There was one case where a student from the University of Chicago was found dead a few months before the killing of Bobby Franks, and the police, the bullet in that student's head matched a gun that was found in Leopold's bedroom. Another case was that there was the kidnapping of a taxi driver, a cab driver, and in fact he was mutilated, sexually mutilated, and after they were arrested for the killing of Bobby Franks, this taxi driver identified them as the two men who had kidnapped him. So there were very serious crimes that were linked to Leopold and Loeb. You might ask the question, why were they never prosecuted for those crimes? And I think the answer to that is because Robert Crowe, the evidence was not that strong to connect them to these other crimes. It would have been an uphill battle for Robert Crowe, the state's attorney. And I think politically, he was not willing to take the risk of suffering a defeat. And he was a politician. Crowe wanted to become mayor of Chicago, and his political ambition was linked to his success as a state's attorney. And I get the feeling that he probably would have been defeated if he'd have tried to prove the guilt of Leopold and Loeb in these other cases, and it's a risk that he wasn't prepared to take. And I think just incidentally, Robert Crowe is another new thing about my book is bringing out the complexity of Robert Crowe, who was Darrow's opponent in the hearing, the courtroom hearing. And Crowe was a fascinating character, extremely clever, extremely charismatic, extremely ambitious, and very much a politician. And as I said, his ambition was to become mayor of Chicago. He was defeated in that ambition only because crime in the 1920s was so out of control that he really was defeated by it. Despite his competence and despite his cleverness, he was not able to solve the problem of organized crime in Chicago, and as a result, his political ambition was disappointed, and he never did become mayor of Chicago.
And Crowe had faced Darrow before also.
That's right. It was a very tight little world, that world of Chicago politics and law, and all of these protagonists. Darrow's, the lawyers who helped Darrow in the Leopold and Loeb case, the state's attorney, they all had experience of each other in the courtroom in previous cases, and only 1 year before, Darrow had faced off against Crowe in the prosecution of a Chicago politician called Fred London, who was being prosecuted by Crowe in an attempt to get London out of the way politically, and Darrow stepped in and defended London, and Darrow won that case in 1923 and defeated Crowe. So Crowe saw this Leopold and Loeb case also as a chance to get back at Darrow. And so it was very much, if you take it in the broader context and do what I did, which is do this kind of research which tries to encompass as many different facts as possible, then I think what's valuable in that kind of research is to draw out all these different examples and all these different cases that bring a kind of context and a background to Leopold and Loeb that make it even more fascinating than it seems at first sight.
Simon Botts is my guest today, and he's the author of For the Thrill of It, Leopold Loeb and the Murder That Shocked Chicago, a fascinating book. Is it your opinion, then, that you know they were able to commit this ruthless murder of Bobby Franks, a 14-year-old boy, so easily because they had actually killed before?
I think that's certainly part of the picture. I think the other picture is that something, I mean, I think whenever I talk about this case, people always ask me, why did they do it? And I have to confess, despite the fact that I've spent 6 years doing the research and writing of this case, I can't come up with a definitive answer. And I think that you have to ask the question, why do these teenagers who are very young, I mean, they're 18 and 19, why do they have such a lack of emotion, of normal human emotion? And my suspicion is that something was going on in the family life of perhaps one or both of these boys that we, of course, cannot discover. We cannot know because family life is private, and one can never know what kind of abuse goes on inside a family or what kind of things happen in a family setting. The other thing is that there's very clear evidence from Nathan Leopold's psychiatric report that he was a very small child for his age. He was also very weak. He was very scholarly. He had no interest in sports, and he was bullied and teased by his classmates at a very young age. And I think this also had a psychological effect on him. I think the other thing that came out in the courtroom that was brought out was that both of them had very difficult relationships with their governesses. That with Nathan Leopold, there's evidence that he had some kind of sexual relationship with his governess at the age of 12. When Leopold was only 12 years old, there was something going on between him and his governess.
And how old was she?
And she was in her 30s.
Uh-huh.
And so, and she, in fact, I know for a fact that she was having sex with Leopold's elder brother, who was then 17 at the time. And Leopold's mother, in fact, was an invalid who was bedridden. Leopold's father was very much engaged in business, didn't really know what was going on inside his family, wasn't paying much attention, and so there's a lot going on in that with Nathan Leopold. He's having this very peculiar home life. His parents are, in a sense, absent. He has a governess who is behaving in a sexual way with the boys, and on top of that, he's being bullied at school.
So sexual abuse is a factor in the case, is what you're saying?
Yes, I think so.
And to what degree, then, was homosexuality a factor in the case? Again, I understand that you feel that Leopold's book is self-serving, and no doubt it is, but, you know, he was very upset to think that people would... The only thing he really would say about the case in the book was that it wasn't a sex crime, and he wanted to get that on paper, you know, on the record. So to what degree did homosexuality play a role in this relationship or the crime?
Well, again, he's being very self-serving when he says it's not a sex crime, because if you go back to the psychiatric reports of 1924, Leopold, and it's very clear about this, there's no ambiguity whatsoever, but when Leopold and Loeb first discussed doing the crime, several months before it happened, Leopold is saying to Loeb that he wants to sexually abuse, to rape the victim, and that he wants the victim to be a girl. And it's something you can't explain, all these different factors, but it's in the report. There's no question about it. So there is a sexual element to it. And Leopold also confessed that he got a sexual pleasure out of having someone in his power, and that sex for him was only exciting if there were a sadistic element inside it. Leopold and Loeb were in a very strange relationship, that Richard Loeb wanted to commit these crimes. He pictured himself as a master criminal. And Nathan Leopold was so pleased that Richard Loeb wanted to have him as a friend that Nathan Leopold was willing to do anything that Richard wanted. Richard needed Nathan because Richard needed an audience for his crimes. Nathan Leopold wanted Richard because he wanted to be, his fantasy was to be the slave, the subservient person in this relationship to the king, and Richard was the king in Nathan's fantasy. So it's a very intricate kind of picture that I try to tease out in the book. So this question of homosexuality, there were sexual relationships between the two boys. Richard was giving sex to Nathan in exchange as a sort of bait to keep bringing Nathan into these crimes and to get his participation into these crimes. I think Richard was kind of indifferent, perhaps, to the sexual aspect of it, and for Nathan it was a crucial ingredient, and it was something that he desired very much.
Well, other authors have drawn the conclusion that Leopold and Loeb would never have committed these crimes without the other. Do you share that belief?
I think that's probably true. I think that in a way their two personalities mesh together, and each. And in fact, this is why another question that people have asked me is, why were they not tried separately? Why were they put on trial together? And the reason for that was that Darrow's defense was that they meshed so much together and they complemented each other that his defense was that they created almost like a joint mental illness. They each had a mental illness and each other's mental illness fed on the others. And so to understand the crime, you can only really understand it through their relationship. And I think that's certainly true.
And they were imprisoned together. That seems like an odd thing.
Yes, well, they were sent initially to Joliet Prison, and which is the old prison. It was established in 1858, and a very unpleasant prison because it was very run down. And then Nathan was sent to the new prison in Stateville, which is a few miles away, which was a very modern prison. And then 6 years later, Richard was also transferred to Stateville, and then they ended up together in Stateville. And the thing about Stateville was that the prison guards weren't paid very much. I think they were paid about $100 a month. And because Nathan and Richard had a lot of money that they were able to use to bribe the guards, and so they really had the run of Stateville Prison. They had no restrictions on each other, on where they were in the prison, for example, and they had free rein of it. So
interesting. And of course, Loeb was killed in prison.
He was indeed, because it came out that he had $500. Each, which is a lot of money in the 1920s and 1930s, and this money was supplied to him by his brothers, and he was using his money to bribe guards, and he would have sex with other prisoners, and in 1936 he was murdered by another prisoner in the shower room in Joliet Prison. And Nathan Leopold was very upset, of course, that his companion had been killed. And there's a very moving account in Nathan's autobiography of how he rushed to the hospital ward in the prison, and the doctors were trying to save Richard's life, but eventually the wounds were too deep, and Richard died, and Nathan was there in the hospital ward when he died.
It's a fascinating book. It's called For the Thrill of It, Leopold Loeb and the Murder That Shocked Chicago, and the author is my guest today, Simon Batts. Simon, thank you so much for spending some time talking about your book with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me. That was a very enjoyable conversation.
That's all the time we have for From the Bookshelf this week, but we'll be back again next week with another great program. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org to hear this program or other episodes of the show that you may have missed. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf production staff, Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. For KUSP, I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening, everybody.